deeply that it was the deathless man, and not me, my grandfather had come looking for. The heat overwhelmed me, and I sat down on the end of one of the cots. The barman reappeared, with a pale blue plastic bag under his right arm. "This it? Stefanovich?" He held it out to me. I opened my backpack for him, and he folded it inside. "All I know is, he collapsed outside the bar, a couple of nights after they brought those kids in. They thought maybe he was drunk, at first. But I told them, he only ordered water." "Water? Was he alone?" "Look, place was crawling with people I didn't know. Nurses, doctors. I barely remember him, let alone who he was with." I lifted my backpack onto my shoulder. "You'd better sign for this," he added. I did, slowly, hoping that he would make the connection. But his eyes told me he had already done this on his own.
Hattie Morahan was reading The Tiger's Wife by Taya Obrecht. The abridger was Sally Marmion, the producer was Elizabeth Allard. And the story continues on Monday.
The Digital Station on radio, TV and online. BBC Radio 4 Extra.
Well, in a quarter of an hour, a trainee diplomat gets to put his new skills to the test at home in the Yorkshire Dales. But will he survive the experience? Bruce Bedford's Maya Farm is our afternoon drama. First, the mystery of the missing Mona Lisa, stolen in 1911, is about to be solved. But is it the end of the story? R.A. Scotty's The Lost Mona Lisa is read by Nicholas Grace.
The two men angled themselves to catch the sun. For added warmth, each cradled a snifter of Napoleon brandy. They made a roguish pair, the journalist adventurer who never allowed the facts to stand in the way of a good story, and the seasoned scam artist. A French newspaper lay open on the table between them. Le Matin of the 4th of January, 1914. Carl Decker knew the self-anointed Marquise as a confidence man with a taste for high life and fine art. And after the usual exchange of pleasantries, their conversation turned to the headline story, Mona Lisa Returns to the Louvre.
"You know, I have always been deeply interested in art," Eduardo de Valfierno began. "I have always felt that the man who made two great pictures bloom, where there had been only one before, was a benefactor of mankind. You understand, of course, Mona Lisa was not stolen to be sold. The painting only appeared to be the prize to Vincenzo Perugia's elementary mind." The Mona Lisa thief, Perugia, was in jail, and the lost Leonardo was back in the Louvre. Yet this Marquise seemed to be suggesting that the case was still not closed. Whatever his motive, Valfierno confessed to a deception. His partner in crime was a pale wisp of a Frenchman named Yves Chaudron. Chaudron was the talent, and Valfierno the front. Chaudron had begun his professional life as a painter, but lacking any creative instinct, he had drifted into art restoration, then into the more profitable field of art falsification. And his skill was described as the uncanny sort that breaks the heart of the collector. In their early days in Buenos Aires, they enriched the Argentine with works of the popular 19th century painter Bartolomé Murillo. Murillo painted sweet Madonnas, loved by Latin widows.
Valthierno would start every morning with a stack of newspapers, circling each black cross that announced the death of a prosperous Argentinian. He was the soul of tact when he approached a grieving widow. He would suggest that she buy a Murillo and donate it to the church as a memorial to her dearly departed. As fast as Chaudron could paint the fakes, Valthierno palmed them off. Decker had met Valthierno in Buenos Aires, and sometime later he bumped into him again in Mexico. Valthierno and Chaudron were working the Murillo market, but they had a new and riskier operation. They were selling the same celebrated work again and again to well-heeled tourists. Buyers would be offered a famous Murillo that hung in a museum in Mexico City. Buyers asked few questions, hoping ignorance would insulate them from whatever unsavory activity was involved, and they would return home to await delivery. The Murillo would arrive, along with a batch of newspaper clippings, all undated. A typical lead read, "Yesterday, an outrage occurred, and a priceless Murillo was ripped from its frame." If a buyer returned to Mexico City and saw the original still in the museum, Valthierno would say that to avoid embarrassment, the museum was passing off a copy as the true work. Painting and peddling the same canvas grew boring. Filthy rich, Valthierno and his master forger sailed for Paris, where, by 1911, the fleecing of American millionaires was a cottage industry. They had arrived at the right place, with the right experience to hatch the most brazen art swindle ever attempted. They would sell Mona Lisa not once, but six times. Chaudron would paint six Mona Lisas. Valthierno would steal the original and sell each forgery to a millionaire collector as the authentic Leonardo. Since she could never be shared or even acknowledged, each buyer would believe that he possessed the true Mona Lisa. Chaudron became a habitué of the Louvre, his easel set up openly in the Salon Carré. Because of museum policy, he could not make his copy the same size as the original. Unfazed, he began a smaller replica of the Mona Lisa. Enlarged slightly, it became his template. While he painted, Valthierno travelled to Italy in search of an antique bed or armoire dating from around 1500 and large enough to cut into six panels, measuring 31 by 21 inches. Chaudron primed the panels to seal the wood, following the typical Renaissance procedure, and, using a fine drill, he simulated the damage caused by insects. A master like Chaudron would never make an obvious mistake. But no artist can reproduce every line, every shadow, and every dimension of a painting. If the best forgery is placed beside the original, an expert may spot the differences. But Chaudron's Mona Lisas would never be seen with Leonardo's. When the paint dried on each new work, Valthierno sailed to the States. To avoid arousing suspicion, he made six separate trips over the span of a year. On each crossing, he carried a new Mona Lisa in his Vuitton luggage. Reproductions of masterworks had become commonplace. Each time he declared his cargo and passed through New York customs without incident. By the summer of 1911, the sting was set. The six forgeries were stashed safely in a New York bank vault and ready for sale, each with a price tag roughly equivalent to $15 million today. The six sheep had been seduced and were lined up to be fleeced. Only one step remained. Mona Lisa had to vanish from the Louvre. Valthierno needed someone with inside knowledge and recruited Vincenzo Leonardo Perugia. Perugia had been employed by the Louvre and was both familiar with the museum and a familiar presence to the guards. And he had built the glass box frame for Mona Lisa. He, in turn, recruited two accomplices, the Lancelotti brothers. Late in the afternoon of Sunday, the 20th of August, the three men visited the Louvre. One of them carried a brown paper parcel containing the uniform of museum workers, three starched knee-length white smocks. Crowds were thin in the Salon Carré, and the guard was drowsy. By the 4 o'clock closing hour, the three had disappeared. They were crouched in the darkness of a storage room, in which they shared a hunk of cheese and a small flask of wine whilst waiting for morning. Because the Louvre was closed to the public on Mondays, the only people in the galleries would be maintenance men and security guards. Around 6:30 a.m., the museum workers began arriving. The three thieves, dressed in the anonymous white smocks, mingled easily. With one of the Lancelottis serving as lookout, Perugia and the other brother removed the painting and passed unnoticed through the empty galleries to the service stairway. On the small landing, Perugia took a screwdriver from his pocket and unfastened the outer frame. Opening the glass box that he had constructed was easy. Perugia slid the painting under his smock and dashed down the stairs. The Lancelottis returned to keep watch.
Then, Valfiano confided, for the first time our beautiful scheme failed to click. The door at the bottom of the staircase was locked, and the key he had given Perugia did not fit. He blamed the Italian for being careless. He had repeatedly instructed Perugia to go to the Louvre and test the key. Imagine, that one little lapse nearly ruined us.
With his screwdriver, Perugia removed the brass doorknob and was starting on the lock when he heard his lookout's whistle. With Mona Lisa under his smock, the instant he heard the footsteps of the plumber sove behind him, he began cursing that some fool had locked the door. Sove, using his master key and a pair of pliers, opened it. After that unwitting deed, the rest was a walkover. The American buyers had been told to read the newspapers on Tuesday, the 22nd of August. But in the first editions, there was no word. There wasn't even a white lie, noting that she had been removed for cleaning. The Marquise had imagined every possible scenario, except the actual one. No one at the Louvre had noticed Mona Lisa was missing. The story broke on the following day. The sting moves swiftly. Valfierno contacted each expectant buyer and arranged the deliveries. The forgeries netted the equivalent of $90 million, and the conspirators kept the prize, the true Leonardo, which they left hidden in Perugia's apartment. They divided the money and disappeared.
"We would have returned the painting voluntarily to the Louvre in due time," the Marquise told Decker, "had not a minor member of the cast idiotically run away with it."
Perugia never understood that Mona Lisa herself was not for sale. Although he had been paid handsomely, he'd gambled away the money on the Riviera and soon was looking for more. He had no idea how to dispose of Mona Lisa until he saw art dealer Alfredo Geri's advertisement. In Casablanca, as the muezzin was chanting the sunset call to prayer, Valfierno finished his story. 18 years later, in 1932, Decker broke the story. But was it the true one? That Decker had the scoop and sat on it seems highly improbable. That the two men happened to meet on the day the missing Mona Lisa returned to the Louvre seems more than serendipity. Was Decker in Casablanca at all? There are no stories dateline Morocco, with his byline, in the New York Journal of January 1914. And what of the gentleman thief Marquese Eduardo de Valfierno? His name, in translation, is the Marquis of the Gate of Hell. He reads like a stock character. Since Decker never revealed the Marquise's true name or offered any corroborating evidence, nothing can be verified. And if Perugia was not the lone thief and Valfierno and his expert forger were fictions, the mystery remains. Who masterminded the theft? And even more puzzling, why? Carl Decker died in 1941, and Valfierno was buried with him. Only his alter ego, Yves Chaudron, lives on in the list of history's legendary forgers. Mona Lisa doesn't get about much anymore. France now has a law forbidding her from leaving the country. But 6 million people visit the Louvre each year, and it is safe to bet that just about every one of them stops to see her. She hangs in splendid isolation, alone, except for François I, who gazes from the painting across the gallery at the woman who had captured his fancy so many years before. François is still keeping a possessive eye on his Mona Lisa.
The Lost Mona Lisa by R.A. Scotti was read by Nicholas Grace, and the producer was Duncan Minchell. And on Monday, a young Bill Bryson arrives in Dover on a foggy March morning in 1973. 20 years later, he plans to leave, but decides to make one last trip round Britain before he goes, soaking up the characters and the eccentricities of this sceptred isle. Kerry Shale reads Notes from a Small Island, all next week at 3:15.
BBC Radio 4 Extra.
3 o'clock, hello, good afternoon, it's Joanna Pinnock here with Drama Now, and a real challenge and a half for a fledgling diplomat in the Yorkshire Dales. Paul Downing and Stephen Thorne, voice of Uncle Mort, star in Maya Farm. After that, geese are on the move around the UK. What can we tell about their flight patterns? And we don't normally hear the pips in the 4 o'clock show, but I reckon we might today. More in an hour. But now, a baptism of fire for a bright young thing who's got his heart set on a career with the Foreign Office as he tackles a diplomatic incident in his own backyard.
Can't do you if it's over 15 miles. Clocking off.
Just to Butterdale.
You'll do. Just the one suitcase, then?
Yes, I'll carry the attaché case.
We present Maya Farm by Bruce Bedford.
That's neat. But I can turn the car radio on if you'd rather.
It's not a radio.
Monday, August the 8th. Start of case notes.
You what?
Nothing.
The Yorkshire Dales. Such idyllic countryside, yet harbouring a social confrontation that makes Beirut seem cosy.
You've been there, then?
What? Oh, Beirut? No, not yet.
Two bitterly opposed parties, and a social gulf unbridged by years. A microcosmic example...
You're a social worker, then?
No, down for the vac. They open the gates now and then. Great to escape from the dreaming spires.
Oh, aye. Sort of parole, then?
Yes, very good.
A microcosmic example of the world's great trouble spots, presenting just as great a challenge to the diplomat, taxing to the utmost his skills, endurance, and diplomacy.
Oh, my God.
Don't whinge, Simon. You get up there and do it. Daddy thinks you're super Foreign Office material. Probably. And he's potty about case studies. You slip him a great fat case study on just how diplomatic you can be. God, even in Yorkshire. And he'll wilt. Now, don't touch me there, Simon.
Oh.
You sick then?
Only in the head.
I see. Bill's no good then.
Transport me to oblivion.
Oh, these fancy names. Dunroman, Shenu, Acapulco, Bloody Villa. Used to be just numbers.
Just take me home.
Oh, Simon's coming home. Why now, John? So many vacations, and this is the first time he's coming home?
Oh, there's... Well, Well, they keep them really busy down there, Oxford. The daft holidays going on for ages, but work spills over, Simon said, didn't he? And all those charity committees he's been on. Save the seals.
Save the children.
Save the Welsh.
Wales, don't poke. It's not baked yet.
Save electricity. A great saver, our Simon.
Oh, that reminds me.
Yes, I saved the stale bread in the bin. Breadcrumbs?
No. Beatrice, what's the time?
Gone five. Yeah. You'll need locking up again.
Right. There we go. Stale bread and water. And count yourself lucky, the Mother Superior's far from pleased.